and a lot of guests for a new house. You've lived here in Portland for some time before buying the house, so you know all these people and just brought your friends. You have many more friends to bring to this nice facility. I understand that there was an idea to have a havan or yagya, but life was so busy that we're doing this? Something like that? Let me make your mind more peaceful and happy by describing something. 1975 was the grand opening of Krishna Balaram Temple. Maybe you read about it in Lilamrita, or I'll describe because I was there. The essence of what I'm going to narrate is what we just did was the essence of the yagya. So we've done it. He didn't attend the Bhagavatam class. I and mine. Like the Juhu Temple that was purchased at a time when there was jungle in Juhu, and the devotees were asking because someone had wanted to give it at a very, very, very low price because it was some generosity. So it was so far away from downtown, the devotees were saying, but Prabhupada, all the action is downtown. Prabhupada insisted for Juhu that it was where it is. And now look at what Juhu is. Similarly, the Krishna Balaram Temple was so far from Vrindavan town. The devotees were saying the same. People won't come here. Everyone's downtown. No, here. So, after, now that the temple is built, it's so congested. More congested, it's as congested as downtown, or more congested than downtown, because it's the center of life. So many people come, and so on. So, with great focus and very strong devotional effort, such strong devotional effort that the person that designed the temple and guest house, he's from Amsterdam, an architect named Surabhi Abhi Palyantam Das. Prabhupada gave him the name, but Surabhi. He not only designed the temple, but oversaw the construction of the temple. And they had 300 workers in shifts around the clock. 300, and then another 300, and then another 300, then another so three shifts of 300 workers. Prabhupada wanted it finished. He wanted to see it completed during his lifetime and didn't want to wait. Because there was an urgency to that mission of completing the Krishna Balaram Temple. And for the deity installation, there were, those of you that have been to the Krishna Balaram Temple, they were up on the upper level, but not yet on the altar with the blindfolds over their eyes and getting ready for the yagya. And in the sunken area of the temple courtyard, where the tamal tree is growing, Prabhupada invited the Goswamis of Vrindavan. The Goswamis of Vrindavan means the descendants of the six Goswamis pujaris, because the six Goswamis didn't have children, but they had pujaris. who had children. So they weren't really Goswamis, just descendants of the Pujaris of the Goswamis, but they carried this hereditary Goswami title. And amongst the main temples of Vrindavan, each with their Goswami and Goswami families, there was one principal person amongst the Goswamis, Vishvambhar Goswami, who was the descendant of Gopal Bhatta Goswami. It's a wonderful story. Gopal Bhatta Goswami previously was the son of Venkata Bhatta, so he was Gopal Bhatta. Venkata Bhatta was the chief priest in Sri Rangam. I want to talk about Lord Kapila Dev, but I'm getting off on these other stories. But anyway, Lord Chaitanya, in the course of his travel in South India, when he came to Sri Rangam and he saw the beautiful deity of Ranganath, he was in ecstasy of love of God, and he began chanting with his arms raised and dancing jubilantly. Tears were streaming from his eyes like syringes, not these kind but these kind, and dancing and dancing in ecstasy. And the South Indian priest had never seen anything like that before. And the chief priest, Venkata Bhatta, came and invited this 24-year-old sannyasi. By then he was 25-year-old sannyasi. Very, very beautiful in feature and golden complexion and very tall. "Please come to my home." And he honored him as a cultured Vaishnava will honor a sannyasi. He bathed his feet and drank the water of his feet and gave to his family members and honored Lord Chaitanya and invited Lord Chaitanya. "It's the beginning of the rainy season. I invite you, please stay in my home for the duration of the rainy season." So he obliged this very cultured Vaishnav, Venkata Bhatta, and in the family was his young son, Gopal, who was given the service of a little boy assisting a sannyasi. And Gopal was very happy. Day and night and night and day, he was serving Lord Chaitanya. And naturally, in the course of the 4 months, he became very attached. And when Lord Chaitanya was ready to go, he wanted to go. And Lord Chaitanya said, "You stay and serve your parents. And at the proper time, they will give you their permission. And then you should go to Vrindavan. And when you go to Vrindavan, you take the association of Rupa and Sanatan Goswami." They're already there. So Gopal is much younger in age than Rupa and Sanatan. So it was not just a child attachment, it was a transcendental attachment to the Lord, to Lord Chaitanya. So after some time, his parents, being elderly, they gave their permission, "You go." So he went. And when he went to Vrindavan, he took residence in a remote place, very quiet place, but a place where, one of the areas where Radha and Krishna would perform their Rasa Leela. Very sacred place, quiet, sacred place. And from the time he was just a 6-year-old boy to the time he went to Vrindavan, from his father and the acharyas in Sri Rangam, he learned all about deity worship, because that's what his father did. But he also knew the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. So he had written one book describing how to do deity worship, how to have perform sangskaras, how to observe Janmashtami, how to take sannyas, how to perform the duties of household life, how to this and how to that. It's a how-to manual. With all scriptural references and all the mantras and all the tantras and everything. And when he reached Vrindavan after some time, he gave that to Sanatan Goswami and said, please put this in a publishable form so the Vaishnavas, the followers of Lord Chaitanya, can appreciate it. Just one request. Don't mention my name. So it's said that Hari Bhakti Vilas, very important book that's just now being translated by our Sanskrit school in Govardhan, and so we'll be able to read it in English if you don't read Sanskrit. And Gopal Bhatt was really the author, but Sanatan Goswami bears the authorship name because he just put it in a form that was suitable. So the Gopal Bhatta, because now he's in North India, he had the desire since childhood to one day go to the Gandakini River and receive some Shalagram Shilas. Very nice description. So he went at the right season when you can travel, and traveled by foot, and each place, just as Lord Chaitanya had done, and was common for those who were renounced, because he never married, he stayed at one Brahmin's home somewhere along the way. And the Brahmana was very pleased to have such a saintly person in his home. So they spent the whole night just discussing Krishna Katha. And in the morning when he was bidding Gopal Bhatta farewell, he made one request. He said, please give your blessing that I may have a child, a son, who can carry on my worship. And if this comes to pass, by your mercy, I promise you, my firstborn son will come and serve you. That's had such a wonderful Vaishnava exchange. So be it. May you have a wonderful son that can carry on this form of devotion that you have. What a wonderful thing that will be. And then he continued on to the Gandakini River, and he gathered a number of shilas in a like a pail, because he just from the bottom of the water and examined them, because he knew the art, because he had been trained. And then he was descending down from the hill, and he was feeling in a very Vaishnava mood of humility, I don't have the qualification to worship Narayan in this way. So he went back to the river and started placing the shilas in the river, and they jumped back into his pail, indicating, I guess they want to be worshipped, so I'll keep them. And he went back to Vrindavan, and he worshipped them in a very grand way. You can, when you visit the Radharaman temple, you can see the place where he did his worship. And one day, some young man came to his door and said, my name is, whatever his name is, and I am told that you are Gopal Bhatta Goswami, and I've come here to serve you. He said, oh, and who are you? He said, do you remember when you went to get your shilas and you stopped at the house of one Brahmin? I was born as his first son, and when I became of mature age, he sent me to come here and serve you. I'm here to serve you for the rest of my life. So that young man became married and was in charge of the worship. He, Gopal Bhatta, trained him, and he became in charge of the worship. And over the generations, it's now, I think, 13 generations, something like that. But during Srila Prabhupada's time, there was Vishvambhar Goswami, And then following him was Padmanabha Goswami. And he has a number of sons also. So that Goswami line. When Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, just in the early stage of his Vanaprastha life, Padmanabha Goswami made an arrangement with the Goswami of the Damodar, Radha Damodar temple, that he would have some nice room just off of the courtyard. At that time, Vrindavan was very quiet. Very quiet. There were some people coming, but it was very quiet. So it was not so public like it is today where Prabhupada stayed. It was just a very quiet situation. So, something like 20 rupees a month for the rooms, or 14 rupees a month, or whatever it was. Something quite insignificant. Two rooms and a little area where he could sit and practically see the deities from there. So that same Vishvambhar Goswami, Prabhupada requested to be in charge of the installation of Krishna Balaram. The reason being, he was expert. Another reason being was that he had the respect of all the other Goswamis of the other temples because of his capability and seniority. And because of those two things, those Goswamis wouldn't fault. It wasn't done properly kind of talk, because they were doing it themselves. Very intelligent. So they did the installation. He requested, and they consented, and they performed a three-day ceremony of installation. Even before the first day was setting the platform, because there's rules about how many inches, and bus to, and this direction, and this color flag, and so many, yeah, and this corner, and this corner, and so many things. And down to precision. And then the yajna began. And maybe some of you have experienced this, but it's very festive. And according to the standards of yajna, there are four types of priests. One who knows the mantras, one who knows the procedure, one who knows the various meters and melodies for the mantras, and one who's the referee. And I didn't know all of that when I watched, as a young brahmachari, watching this fascinating experience. And I did notice that the referee was really busy, because they kept making... If you make one mistake, you have to go back until you haven't made a mistake, and then do it again until the coast is clear, and then you keep going until there's some discrepancy, and then you back up. And so they were doing a lot of back up and going forward on the direction of the referee. That's the rules. And on the side of that sunken courtyard of the Vrindavan temple, Prabhupada had arranged a 24-hour kirtan party. So I happened to be in his quarters one afternoon when he was having darshan, and he was asking, how is the yajna going? The devotees were describing what I just said. There were lots of backing up and redoing things that they made errors. And, some little heated arguments about what was an error and what wasn't an error, and those kinds of things. And Prabhupada laughed and said that the real yajna is Harinam yajna. The other procedures, that's nice, it's authorized and bona fide, but the real sacrifice, that pure, because the preliminaries is to create auspiciousness for inviting Pran Pratishtha, inviting the Supreme Lord to come and personally, formally accept the worship. It was a fantastic ceremony. But Prabhupada's comment, and it's scripturally confirmed, in this age of Kali, the real sacrifice is not the fire one and the mantras and oblations into the fire, although they're certainly bona fide, but the essence of that for our age is what we just did. So we didn't have a fire, we had nice sankirtan. That was it was two events that I've experienced in terms of deity worship. Even in New York, where we installed Radha Govinda, it was at least experientially, the installation of Krishna Balaram was euphoric. It was out of this world. And similarly, the installation of Panchatattva, it was spiritually intoxicating. It was just amazing. And Yadubara was one of the singers while the Pran Pratishtha was going on. It's the same melody that you just sang. Did you know that? During the... for hours he sang that melody. And it was so nice. And you know Yadubara, right? Very, very nice. I didn't know that he could sing so nicely, but it was... everyone was dancing and floating and hitting the ceiling and hitting the walls. It was just ecstatic. Completely ecstatic. So, I don't know if I should say this, but I will. I was recently in China, and I met an 80-year-old college professor who... He's so capable that he's an advisor to the government. And when the government wants to do things of preserving Chinese culture, I don't know exactly what his field is, but he's very interested in spiritual subject matters, and he was describing his projects. He asked me about the Mayapur project because he heard, so I started describing, and he said, "I want to go there. When would be a good time to go there?" I said, "The good time to go there is when they complete the Temple of Vedic Planetarium and they move." So when you hear about, if your schedule permits you to attend the grand opening of the Temple of Vedic Planetarium when they move the deities, please go if you can. And you might just continue on and go to the spiritual world in your self-same body. It's that kind of an experience. Crowds is something I don't like, but I just even lost the sense of crowds. It was just amazing. Just amazing. You could feel Lord Chaitanya has come. It wasn't just the deity. It was amazing. I don't know how to properly describe. The whole being was just transformed. And just carried for a month, just floating. Please go if you can. Besides, the Vedic Planetarium won't be completed, but they'll have certainly a very clear plan, a description. I plan to take this professor and meet the devotees that are part of the planetarium team and have the design, and you explain to him the conception, because he knows about Chinese astronomy. And I told him Chinese astronomy and Vedic astronomy the same, because they have this in Beijing. They have a big park. And I'm from New York, where you see lots of people in Central Park or rush hour. There were more people in this park on a Tuesday afternoon at 2:00 than I see in New York at rush hour going into the subways. A gazillion people all over the place just going to see this, what they call Temple of Heaven. And it's, I'm way off topic, but it's time to having a nice time. I want to talk about Lord Kapila Dev. So they have a park where you have to pay to go in, and there's wide avenues that it's just a sea of people. And you walk about a quarter of a mile, half a mile, and then there's this mini mountain, and you go up on the mini mountain. It's worship of Indra and the demigods. They don't use that name. They say the king of heaven, sun god, moon god, wind god, you know, sea god. And they have altars where they would worship them. That's the main temple of heaven. Then over there is the history of the Ming Dynasty that built it and used it. And over there is some of the other Upadevatas, the three structures. Very interesting. Vedic culture during Chinese history. And then go down another half a mile and up another mini mountain and in this park and with, you know, another zillion people over there. And you go up and it's the astronomy. And it's Vedic astronomy and Chinese history. You know, the whole picture of the cosmos. Very interesting. So I was discussing this with this professor. There was one culture. I don't know what the language was, but there was one culture, one body of ancient wisdom. This is, before Confucius was around, historically. And then you go to the next one. It's where they, the emperor that was over there somewhere was a fasting place when they would have, festival days, Janmashtami or whatever it was they were observing. And he would fast the fasting place and come over, and then he would stand on these numerology things where it's, numbers of squares of marble and something and something and something. He'd stand in the middle and speak to the heavens. And the professor said, I tried it. I stood in that middle and I felt something. Anyway, and then they would perform awful sacrifices of not very nice Vedic ways of doing sacrifices, but offerings to the devatas. Right in Beijing, as a tourist spot for the whole of the gazillion people of China, in the country's capital. So the relationship between China and India, it's right there. You don't have to be a historian or scholar to find it. There it is. How did I get off on speaking about that one? Do you remember? Okay. Yeah. So the during this weekend, Thanksgiving weekend in Seattle, I spoke on a topic about Lord Kapila Dev's teachings, and I want to, on the way over here, it was suggested that maybe I could summarize. I had to take birth again. No. Okay, so I was invited to give a little summary, and I'll do it a little differently than just a factual summary because it's too much. It was so many hours a day for so many days, so how do you distill that into some little capsule? I'll just start with just giving a little background on what inspired that particular topic. The topic, in Lord Kapila Dev's teachings, there are eight verses that are known in Gaudiya Vaishnavism as very beautiful verses that are glorifying explaining the value of sadhu sangha, association of saintly people, So I found out about that from a devotee named Dravida. And I want to express some appreciation for Dravida for just a moment. Dravida grew up in a aristocratic, wealthy family from Long Island. He read one of Prabhupada's books and immediately came to the Hare Krishna temple in Brooklyn and joined the temple. And from that time, he was engaged in working with the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust and very quickly became one of the editors, and since that time has been one of Prabhupada's editors. One of the editors of Prabhupada's books. That's a very delicate task, to take the words of your spiritual master and edit them. Because the editing is not for content, it's for grammar and syntax and those kinds of things. But the eloquence and jewel-like brilliance of Dravida is, I'll just share two things. His part of his sadhana is he's up every morning at 2 o'clock and he chants his rounds before Mangalarti. And so that after Mangalarti, we're chanting our rounds, he's reciting slokas. He's been doing this for 35, 40 years. And he has different ways over a period of time that he's used to have musical accompaniment, sometimes just a tambura, boom, 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 and just singing for 2 hours, slokas. And he doesn't sing it from a book, he sings from memory. He's amazing. You can just like press a button, tell him, give a name. Prabodhananda Saraswati. Press the button. And he'll, you know, for 2 hours, he'll recite Prabodhananda and press another button. Rupa Goswami, Padyavali. And he'll, you know, just go from memory. And very beautiful. And then he'll give you the translation of Prabhupada from his memory, and then his poeticized translation from his memory. He's a brahmachari. He's got a brain he's a brahmachari brain. An amazing memory. So another just illustration of Dravida. One time, we were a group of us, 1,000 devotees, were going on Mayapur Parikrama. That is, you leave the temple and you don't come back for 9 days, and you go the whole route of where Lord Nityananda took Jiva Goswami to visit the places of Lord Chaitanya's pastimes throughout Mayapur, and you camp out at night. And then you put your stuff together in a bag, and put the bag goes into the truck, and off you go by foot, barefoot, to the next place. The next place, and next place, and take prasadam, and take rest, get your stuff off the truck, and set up a tent, and camp out. And then you're in nature, with Lord Chaitanya, having kirtan all day long, walking barefoot in the holy dham. So, one of the places, it was after the first day, those of you that have been to Mayapur, there's Jagannath Mandir at the long end of Bhaktisiddhanta Road, and we camped out there. And then to go to the next place, Nrisingapalli, you have to cross a branch of the Ganges. So they had it nicely planned. They had boats waiting when we got in the early morning, because the sun hadn't come on the horizon, but a little bit of glimmer of morning sunlight. Just imagine. So it's still a little chilly. And, you know, damp morning dew all over the place. And so the devotees, there were two boats, and the devotees got on the boat. They had to make several shuttles back and forth. And as we were crossing the river, one of the boats sank. So all the devotees in that boat that sank got wet. So now there's only one boat to shuttle everybody back and forth across the river. So it was time, had we all crossed the river, it was time for Bhagavatam class. So instead of Bhagavatam class, one devotee, you know him because he's visited here, Prahladananda Swami, He recited Krishna book from memory. And then Dravida recited the Sanskrit verse by verse, as Prahladananda Swami would recite Prabhupada's Krishna book, that's kind of the summary presentation. And they went through two or three chapters, just from memory. Verse by verse, story by story, verse by verse, story by story, verse by verse. It was amazing. And that's just spontaneous. So this is Dravida, and I was having some discussion with him about what would be a nice topic for, we once a year we do seminars together. And that's, we're going to do one together in at Christmas time in Chicago. So I said, I think a very nice topic would be the importance of devotee association. And immediately, just press the Dravida button, and he's reciting Sadhu Sangastaka, singing it. And, you know, I said, where's that from? He said, oh, you didn't know. It's from Lord Kapila Dev's teachings to Devahuti about the importance of association. And then he sang it again slowly in Sanskrit and gave his poeticized translation. It was beautiful. So I said, I want to make a presentation for the devotees so they could hear that. So that's what we just did in Thanksgiving time. Compliments of Dravida Prabhu. I didn't share all that with all the devotees, but I'm sharing it with you. That was the inspiration behind it. So a little quick summary. Lord Kapila is one of the Shaktyavesh avatar forms of the Lord. According to Lord Chaitanya's teachings to Sanatan Goswami, there are six categories of avatars. Avatar is not just a movie, it means one who descends. One who descends from the spiritual world to this realm, bringing the message of God. Sometimes it's God himself, sometimes it's an empowered jiva who manifests that. So that's what Lord Kapila Dev is. He's a Shaktyavesh avatar. I'll list that's one of six, just for your edification, what the others are. See if we can all get them. Leela avatars are most common. Das avatar. Everyone knows those. That's one of six. Manvantar avatars, the Manus. Guna avatars, Brahma, Vishnu, and Lord Shiva. Yuga avatars, those who give the primary means of spiritual perfection for a given age. Yuga avatars. And Shaktivesha avatar, what's the other one? Missing one. Huh? Shaktivesh. So Leela avatar, Manvantar avatar, Guna avatar, Yuga avatar, Shaktivesh avatar. There's another one. Purusha avatar. Very good. Purusha avatar means those forms of Lord Vishnu specific for the purpose of creation. So, Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, Shirodakshaya Vishnu, those three are Purusha avatars. Thank you. Lord Kapila Dev is in the category of Shaktyavesh avatar. And without the detail, he's a particular, there's subcategories of each, and he, at least of Shaktyavesh avatar. And he's of the kind where he, like Dhanvantari, like Dattatreya, like Vyasadev, they give elaborate teachings. They live as sages. And they live for a very long time. Chiranjiva is the term in Sanskrit. They live for long, many, many, many. Their life spans over many generations. Others come and go and they stay. To give this Benedictine teaching, and the teaching that Kapila gave was Sankhya. And Sankhya, literally it means to count, and practically what it is a teaching of the different categories of matter, the 24 elements, and in his teaching he adds another one, time, and then another one, the living entity, and sometimes it's said another one, the supreme soul. Those aren't material elements, those are spiritual elements. And the 24 material elements and the combination of them, you get creation. And he gives teachings that give this analysis of matter and spirit, the purpose of which is to understand what's the root of all existence, so that one can water the root of all existence. Given the example with a tree, if you put water on the root of the tree, all the parts of the tree receive water, without having to water the branches and the limbs and the twigs and the parts of the tree. Just water the roots of the tree. Similarly, in the teaching of Lord Kapila Dev has a component of analysis of matter and spirit, and the unfolding of the elements of matter so that you get creation. But behind it is spirit. And behind the individual spirit soul is the supreme soul, who is the cause of all causes. And so then comes a process of meditation. Another component is because Kapila Dev appeared very early in Satya Yuga. Very early in Satya Yuga. His grandfather was Lord Brahma, that early in Satya Yuga. His father was Kardama Muni, who was a direct son of Lord Brahma. At the very, very beginning, the kickoff of Satya Yuga, just get started. And so, in Satya Yuga, the process, the Yuga Dharma, is meditation. So there's a meditation component. The meditation component is fixing the mind upon the root of all existence. And then the next stage is, in that state of mind fixed upon the root of all existence, serve in a personal way in one's, in the mind, in one's body, and one's soul, fully engaged in fixed, singular, undivided devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, this is just a quick summary, but Lord Brahma, the chief engineer of the whole universe, rather than sometimes it's said he's the creator, but more appropriately, he takes the plan, the blueprint, takes the plan of the Lord, the ingredients of the Lord, the inspiration of the Lord, the intelligence of the Lord, the ability of the Lord, the creative impetus of the Lord, the self-realization of the Lord, takes all of that and makes a universe. And the Lord supplies all the rest. So part of his responsibility in creating universe is to populate it. So he doesn't do it himself. He, from his own body, he creates beings. We can't do that. But Brahma can do that. He's given the ability by Lord Vishnu to do that. He's the creator. So he creates 10 sons. They're named in the Bhagavatam, each of whom are sages. Vashishtha Muni, Bhrigu Muni, Angira Muni, from different parts of his body, Daksha. And Kardamamuni. Kardamamuni is born from the shadow of Brahma. That's pretty cool. And he then requests these sages. First he requests Kardama. Brahma says to his son Kardamamuni, please help me. I require good praja to populate this universe that I've just created. So please assist me. So his answer is, yes, sir. And to accomplish that, he goes to the forest and for 10,000 years engages in meditation, in great austerity, with his mind completely fixed on the personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu. Lord Vishnu is very pleased by his purity of devotion and his wish to serve his father. But he wishes specifically, he desires good praja. I'd like Lord Vishnu as my son. So Lord Vishnu comes in the middle of the forest, riding on the back of Garuda, standing on the back of Garuda, in fact. And the description of the form of Lord Vishnu is very beautiful. And in a very resounding voice, sounding like thunder, he speaks to Kardamamuni and says, I know your heart's desire because I reside within your heart also. And your devotion unto me is perfect. Your desire will be fulfilled. In fact, in 2 days from now, Swayambhuva Manu, the emperor of the universe, is going to come here to this forest with his wife, Shatrurupa. And he's going to request you to accept their daughter as your wife. And you should say yes, because she's very qualified. She'll serve you very nicely. And the two of you will produce very quality children, one of whom will be myself, a plenary expansion of myself. I will come and be your son, just as your heart has desired. And he left. Well, Kardamuni was in ecstasy. He knew, he had audience of the Supreme Lord, and he knew exactly what was going to happen. His heart is fully pure, without material attraction for anything. So Swayambhuva Manu comes 2 days later, just as the Lord said would happen. And Kardamamuni, living in the forest for 10,000 years, being visited by the emperor of the universe, he's jubilant. He immediately rises. He's the brahmana, but he's treating him with such respect. And said, whatever the reason is that you've come this very distant place to ask me for, the answer is yes, whatever it is. Like a blank check, just put in the amount, whatever you want. So Swayambhuva Manu introduces the idea and to marry his daughter, because his daughter has heard about Kardamamuni and it was her desire to marry him. And so Swayambhuva Manu is obliging that desire of his daughter. They became married with one condition, that when there's a son that will be of age to care for your daughter, I will then again go to the forest and continue my practices of meditation, setting an example of not remaining attached in household life. Swayambhuva Manu said, as long as my daughter is protected and cared for, that's fine with me. So they were married, and for a long, 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 long time, she lived as an ascetic in the forest. A princess, the emperor's daughter, lived in that way, just like a brahmani, although she was of royal order, she served in that manner. Very, very expertly, very faithfully, very happily, but she became lean and thin and rather emaciated. And Kardamamuni could understand after some time her heart's desire. She wanted a child. And so he was not only a pure devotee, but he was a a mystic yogi, and he created a city, a flying city, and they went zoom, zoom, zooming all over the cosmos together, and produced very qualified children, 9 daughters, and then during her pregnancy with Lord Kapila Dev, Lord Brahma came and was very pleased with both of them, because the other brothers of Kardama Muni now had wives that were qualified, and the wives were then, at Brahma's direction, given to the different sages so they could also assist Lord Brahma in producing good praja. And Brahma said, in Devahuti's womb is a form of the Lord, and he will deliver both of you, and you'll both become fully self-realized. And Brahma left. So the daughters were married. Kapila Dev was born. Kapila Dev grew. Because he's an incarnation, he appeared as if the son of Kardama Muni and Devahuti, but it's similar to Krishna's appearing as the son of Vasudeva and Devaki. He appeared in that way, and that was his reciprocation of the love of Vasudeva and Devaki for him. And similarly, Lord Vishnu appeared as Kapila Dev to reciprocate with the love of Kardama Muni and Devahuti for the Lord. So, sure enough, when Kapila Dev was of sufficient age, Kardama Muni came before Lord Kapila and said, I'm going to go now. Please take care of Devahuti. And he circumambulated and off he went back to the forest. So now there's Devahuti, having spent so many years serving her husband, such a qualified husband, perfected being husband, providing the personality of Godhead as their son, and he's gone. And she's feeling great separation. In that pain of separation, she's realizing how attached on the platform of the body she is. And she appeals to Lord Kapila Dev, please, you're the personality of Godhead. It's by your potency that I'm covered in this way. It's by your potency that that covering can be removed. Please remove the covering of my bodily identification and my false ego and my sense of being an enjoyer of this body and the senses and being attached, and as a result just being bewildered by the circumstances of illusion. Please act like the axe that cuts to the root this tree of material existence and free me from this bondage, and let me simply be in the position of eternally serving you, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By your kindness, please deliver me. Very heart-rending appeal. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary, says, Kapila Dev just smiled, thinking, my dear mother, what are you talking about? I'm the personality of Godhead. You're my mother. How can you be like a conditioned soul? But you're speaking this way because you want something to be said for the benefit of those who are in bondage. That is your compassion, so I'll oblige your desire. And he speaks about devotional service. He says that by devotional service, one can become free from that bondage. And describes various aspects of devotional service, that it's It's unmixed with material motivation. It's simply to take shelter of the personality of Godhead and unalloyed love, and describes that that's all of that stage of perfection is possible through association with sadhus. I'm just going very quickly over this subject matter. And then these eight verses. Who is a sadhu? The qualifications, how you can recognize, you know, the sadhu test. What are the symptoms of who is a sadhu? And then the results of the association of a sadhu. The very nice metaphor that's given, the metaphor of a creeper, or lata. And as a creeper grows, it needs to cling to something, like a tree or something, and the creeper then grows clinging onto the tree. So, the seed, this is Lord Chaitanya speaking to Sanatana Goswami, that the seed is the taste for spiritual happiness as opposed to material happiness. And that seed for spiritual happiness comes from the association of one who has that happiness, from a sadhu. And the sadhu awakens that tendency within, that's already there within us. And when that taste is there, one becomes attracted. And through that continued association, it's like the creeper grows up the side of the tree. Through that clinging to the, or attached to, the association of the sadhu. And as the creeper grows and grows and grows by the watering process of hearing, eventually the creeper pierces the coverings of the universe and enters into the spiritual sky and touches the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord and produces flowers and fruits at the feet of the Supreme Lord. Beautiful poetic imagery. But the beginning and the continuation of devotional service that he described to Devahuti that cuts this attachment to material existence and allows one to enter into the spiritual existence, it's sadhu sangha. So beautiful verses describing sadhu sangha. And when he finishes those, this is where we ended up just this morning. Devahuti then asks a very profound question. Which type of bhakti or devotional service is best? And Kapila Dev obliges her question. He describes unmixed devotional service. Unmixed by any kind of motivation for karma and gyan, by gaining something from that service, or becoming a knowledgeable person from that service, just in being interested in service to the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. And no other shelter but the Supreme Lord, the one Supreme Lord. No other. It's very singular focus. Rupa Goswami states it this way, that love is exclusive. I was giving the example this morning. Like a faithful and chaste wife does not consider, I have a nice husband, but I think he might be a nice husband, and he also might be a nice husband, and there might be a very nice husband. A faithful, chaste wife doesn't think like that. It's not a thought in her mind. And so it's exclusive. Serving the husband. And in the case of bhakti, it's not many worship. It's just whatever is the root of all existence, that Supreme Personality of Godhead, from that one exclusive shelter, everything required will be there. The stage of perfection will come. And everything that I need in between now and then will be supplied. I don't need to think anything else. This is from the Bhagavad Gita, Vyavasayatmika Buddhi, Ekeha Kuru Nandana. Same idea, just expressed in a different way. So he goes on describing so many things. He describes that characteristic of undivided devotional service, and Devahuti goes on asking many other questions, and he goes on answering those many questions. It's something like undergraduate and graduate study. Prabhupada speaks like that. Bhagavad Gita is undergraduate study, and Bhagavatam is graduate study. So the principles in undergraduate study aren't different principles than in graduate study. It's just more elaborate. 2 plus 2 is still 4 in graduate school. But how you use 2 plus 2 equals 4 is variegated and more intricate. So the Bhagavatam is giving the same message as in Bhagavad Gita. So all you need is Bhagavad Gita to learn it and assimilate it. But to appreciate how deeply the Sankhya portions of Bhagavad Gita are chapter 2, a little bit more in chapter 7, and a whole bunch more in chapter 13. And it's analysis of matter and spirit in different ways. And you study those sections very carefully. That knowledge tells you, this is who I am, that's who God is, I'm very small, God is very great, I should worship Him. Once Prabhupada said, Krishna consciousness is very simple. God is very great, we are very small, so we should serve Him. That is Krishna consciousness. To understand how great God is, that's unlimited. And the more you can understand how great God is, you can understand how small we are. And when you understand how small you are and how great God is, the natural inclination is to want to serve Him. So, sometime maybe you'll want to read that section of the Bhagavatam. And the devotees in Seattle, I don't know, they got their technology team together and they made video recordings and live broadcasts. I was told it was very clear. So it's been recorded, and maybe if you're interested in the subject, you can find out where they're going to put it, and you can listen or watch or hear. It covers a very large portion of the third canto of the Bhagavatam. It's an important topic. It covers 14 chapters of the third canto. It's big. It's not as big as the section that covers the topic of Krishna in the 10th canto, 87 chapters. But very substantial and very deep, very profound and very important. So that's a little summary what we just spent the weekend doing. Anything you'd like to, any comments or questions you want to bring up? Yes?
What are the forms of sadhu sangha? Can you elaborate on physical?
The forms of? The ways in which to do that? That's what you're asking? There's two primary categories, Vani and Vapu. So, Vapu is physical, and in physical sangha, physical association, taking care of physical requirements. Like when when Venkata Bhatta received Lord Chaitanya, or when the Brahmana received Gopal Bhatta. This Vaishnava hospitality, caring for their needs in a serving mood. And when that goes on, hearing from them. Vani seva, hearing and discussing and inquiring. And a very nice example of Sadhu Sangha is Narada's description when he was a small boy serving the Bhaktivedantas in their the inn where his mother was tending. So he did both. And through that Sadhu Sangha, he became Narada. He took and then he applied. That's another part of Sadhu Sangha, is that which you hear, you apply. And that's also service. It's also association. Through the Vani, you don't just hear it, but you bring it in your heart and you live it. That's also service. And through that kind of association, one can effectively grow spiritually. There's something that we discussed this morning from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur that's relevant to your question. When Kapila Dev answers Devahuti's question, what's the best form of bhakti or devotional service? He speaks about, trying to remember the Sanskrit, but one of the words is something shruti karmanam. And the way that Prabhupada translated it, it is from the message of scriptures, your activity should follow the message of scriptures. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, one receives mantra, and the activities that one performs should be in pursuance of the mantra. And then he says, so the Diksha Guru gives mantra, and the Shiksha Guru gives instructions how to perform activities that follow the mantra. So there's two different categories of sadhu, sangha. One who gives mantra and one who gives instructions. It can be the same person, but the instructing guru is to give instructions that nurture the mantra, the following and the fulfillment, the fructification of the mantra. So etiquette-wise, we were discussing this. Maybe you were there or not. The Shiksha Guru is to honor the mood and the way of the instructions of the Diksha Guru and assist that, facilitate that. They're to be respected on an equal plane, and the etiquette between the two of them is giving instructions on the activities that will nurture the meaning of the mantra and the message that has been heard and received. Anyway, so those are some ideas about Sadhu Sangha. Anything else? Yes.
So, I know you discussed this at Seattle where Cardinal Mooney left Kapila Dev after a certain age when he was able to take care of his mother. And I was thinking of that, and the natural question that was asked was, how does one do that when one has the Lord as one's child?
I raised the question, and then somebody else echoed it.
Right. And I was just thinking of the same example of Vasudeva and Krishna, where Lord Krishna appeared and told him,
take me across the river.
Take me now. It was like, you know, you think about this service 10 years from now, and then, you know, when you feel you're up to this ability, then go do this immediately. And I was just thinking about the element of surrender of these great souls.
They're pure devotees. Pure devotees. Yeah. Which comes priority wise, which comes first and which is higher? Something that we wish to fulfill, or something, some instruction that we're given. So for an elevated person, the instruction that we're given comes as the priority. One cannot always do that. Something that I'm going to read from tomorrow, if I pick the right section. Prabhupada describes his own regret that so many years passed when he received the instruction from Bhaktisiddhanta, and it took a while before he says, "I wasted time, but anyway, I did. I never forgot the instruction. I just wasted time in carrying it out. Anyway." When the time was right, he came. Yes.
So the element of not being able to execute a particular instruction up till a certain point in time in life, has that necessity?
I bet they can't hear you over there.
The element of not being able to execute.
There are circumstances when we sometimes cannot execute that which the instruction we're given.
So does that basically mean that since we cannot execute it at a particular point in time, is it an offense?
Is it an offense if we cannot? No. Would you want to say that Prabhupada was offensive to Bhaktisiddhanta? I wouldn't want to say that. He was feeling not qualified. He was feeling not capable. He had a wife and two children. So he was considering, let me prepare myself.
Yeah, the question was not in relation to Srila Prabhupada.
But there's an example. So let's take the example that's everybody's instruction. From whatever and wherever the mind wanders due to its flickering and unsteady nature, bring the mind back under the control of the self. That's an instruction for all of us. Are you ready to do that? Or any one of us? Are any one of us ready to do that? We can practice doing that, but can we do that? We need to qualify ourselves. We need to practice. You have some other example in mind that you're thinking about? Just theoretical.
No, really. The thought that ran through mind was there are so many things in practical life and spiritual life.
Well, give an example.
Like building a temple. Cannot manifest right now.
Okay.
There's something in the mind that you intend to do, like,
fine. There has to be the right time, right circumstance, and so forth. That one has to be thoughtful and a good judge of, is it the right time? You know the story. When Prabhupada was visiting in Montreal and sitting on a park bench, and some man said, "Swamiji, you're a leader of an organization. How many temples do you have?" 100 temples all over the world. Time is separating, etc. So to hold a vision of something and time is separating, that's fine. Don't just twiddle your thumbs and wait for it to happen, but there may be some preparation for it to happen. Anything else? Okay.